Welcome. This is Jean Maroney of Thinking Directions, and today I'm offering a free teaser class on how tactics help thinkers capitalize on their strengths. I have been, teaching thinking tactics for well over 20 years, actually over 25 years, and I've gotten clearer on why they're so useful, which I thought I should share with some people. I assume everyone on this call is a thinker. That's what attracts you to even discussing this. And almost everyone on this call is a fan of Ayn Rand and has read Atlas Shrugged, the theme of which is the role of man's mind, the role of the mind in man's existence. And of course, thinking is the use of the mind. It's how you create values in the world. It's how you live your life. If you do not think, you cannot live a happy life. It's your means of achieving values. So it's a very important topic. And I think one of the things that was a conundrum for me for a long time was, how do I convince people to join a thinking lab when everybody knows how to think, which they do, and most people don't think they need any help in thinking, which is, I don't want to be, which is probably true in the sense that if you're doing fine, you're doing fine. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. But there is a reason for learning tactics. And I think, in fact, it helps the people who are the most efficacious at thinking learn the tactics the fastest and can immediately use them. The people who are a little less efficacious, the tactics are perhaps more important for because they actually get sorted out on what thinking is and they distinguish it from what they've been doing that wasn't effective. But it's actually helpful for everyone. As you know from the sign up, and from the emails you've gotten, this is a teaser for the Thinking Lab. That is my membership program where I have, a library of over 60 thinking tactics and 20 courses, hundreds of hours of material, and a lot of new content every month. I am going to give an advertisement for that a little bit later in the talk, but the main focus of this is to share some new thoughts about how you think and how you manage thinking, and how tactics can be so helpful for this. So, before we get started, I just want to make sure we're on the same page as to what thinking is. One of the problems with being in the field of psychology is that there aren't a lot of objective definitions of some of the terms. So, here's what my definition of thinking. It's a purposeful process of integrating your observations with your existing knowledge and values to reach a new conclusion. The two parts of that are really important are the genus is it's an integration. It's you're taking new data and old data and you're putting them together. And you're doing it in order to figure out something new. It's essentially a purposeful process. You aren't thinking unless you have something you want to figure out. So, for example, planning is a thinking process. What you want to figure out is what order you should do things or how you're going to accomplish some goal. Setting a goal is a thinking process where you're trying to figure out, you have some value you want, and you're trying to figure out what is the result I should try to create in the world, which will have this value significance for me. Or, analysis. Sometimes you're trying to figure there's a problem. Problem solving would be another thinking process. There's a problem you want to try to solve. You see that something's not working the way it is. You want to identify what the problem is and how do you fix it. And as a subset of that, you might analyze the problem. You might break it into parts. That's what analysis is. There are many different thinking processes. All of them are purposeful. All of them involve new observations because at the very least, you are observing new connections that are coming up, but often there's actual real extrospection involved in thinking. And they all involve taking advantage of things you already know. It's not observation is when it's just new information. Thinking is when you're putting it together. There are really only five basic processes in thinking. Every complicated process of thinking you have comes down to these five simple things. One is setting a purpose. If you haven't set a purpose, it's not thinking. You need to know what this mental activity is trying to figure out. Otherwise, it is not thinking. Otherwise, it is just daydreaming or ruminating or free, you know, just emoting or just some other non-purposeful activity. That is the difference between thinking and just ideas going through your head. Second, really important part of thinking, it involves the articulation of thoughts. And here I'm going to introduce a distinction between thoughts and ideas. We need this distinction, and I think these are the right words to use. By an idea, I mean something that has come up from memory. So that could be, you know, an image, right? If you have I have a memory of an incident that happened in a playground when I was about 6 years old. And I have a picture of the sprinkler and me on my scooter and my brother's friends around the sprinkler. It's a very strange memory for me to have come up with. I actually bumped into the sprinkler and I fell down and was very upset. But it's the one that came up when I needed to come up with an image. Okay, but I actually have that picture came up from memory along with some words. Those are ideas when they come up. Sometimes it is words. Sometimes it is words. So, you know, when I thought of the role of the mind in man's existence, the words Atlas Shrugged came up. I didn't have a picture of the novel. I had the word. I had the title. So the point is the things that come up from memory are all images of concretes. Now, some of them are visual images. Some of them are auditory images. So they're sounds, you know, like words are. Actually, some people see visual images of words. Some people hear auditory images of words. Presumably, Helen Keller had tactile images of words. You know, she spelled out all the words that she had, or she did it with Braille. It can be in any of these sense modalities, but it doesn't have to be just visual. So when I say an image, I mean any of that kind. And ideas are all of these, you know, a little more emphasis on the words, but I use ideas very generally. These come up, they come up in the background. You notice them whenever, as I'm talking, various things are hovering in the background. Until you focus on one of these and identify it and put it into words, it is not a thought. A thought is always in words and it's a sentence. So you can have words come up, but to really get the concept, you need to say, you know, the word dog comes up, you say, this is a dog. You actually need the full thought until you are aware. It's the thought that translates the images and the material and the information from memory into an identification and into an awareness. It's not an awareness until you articulate the thought. And this distinction between thoughts and ideas, I think, is very important. It's not made in many places. And it's the difference between thinking and just rambling. If you just kind of, you know, if you just have like phrases and things coming out of your mind, it doesn't add up to anything and you aren't actually saying anything. I'll give you an example of that later. But that's a very important part of thinking. So we've got setting a purpose, articulating thoughts. Now you can articulate thoughts in a case where you're not thinking, where you're just like in the course of a process that's very well organized. Like, for example, if you're washing the dishes, you might have the thought, I need a new sponge. Okay, fine. I wouldn't call that a thinking process because it's just you're identifying something that came up and you're now going to go get a sponge. You're just controlling action. But with thinking, it's a series of thoughts that add up to a conclusion. Now, The next two things that are basic processes of thinking, basic processes that you can, mental actions you can take that are processes you use in thinking, are asking questions and judging what comes up. And of course, this is how you retrieve things. You ask open-ended questions. When I say asking questions, I really mean open-ended questions. So if you have a problem to solve, standard questions that you ask are things like, when did it start? What is the evidence of it? Has this ever happened before? Why do we care about this problem? These are questions where you, in effect, activate things that are stored and get them into awareness. You actually need to be aware of the full context relevant to the problem before you can solve it. And you get that context activated by asking questions and then articulating the answers. You actually have to not just get some ideas swimming in your head, but actually put them all into thoughts. Oh, yes, it started Tuesday at 10 o'clock. You know, what happened at Tuesday at 10 o'clock? The shift changed. Whatever it is, you need to actually get that material out. It's questions how you get material is how you trigger information from memory. And then you articulate them to then be aware. That's how you activate the full context of knowledge. So you can be aware. You can have a grasp of these facts and actual awareness of these facts. And then, of course, part of this assumes that you're judging the results as you come up. Like, is that relevant? Like you ask yourself, when did the problem start? And you say, and the thought comes up, once you realize that the thought has come up, I really hate that this problem comes up so often. And you know, is that relevant to solving the problem? Well, maybe a little bit, but it's not actually an answer to the question you asked. It's very helpful to notice that you did not get an answer to the question that you asked. You need to judge what comes up as to whether it's true or false, relevant or irrelevant. Sometimes what you're judging is this good or bad. You get an idea, well, oh, we could do this. This is an idea of what we could do to solve this problem. And you need to judge, is that a good idea or is that a bad idea? Judging is, what judging is actually doing is you're letting your mind, given the context that's been activated, toad up the value significance of whatever you're asking to be judged. And is it a value or not a value? And of course, there are a lot of different yes or no questions you can ask, but there's always the yes or value option and the no or the non-value option. And that's absolutely necessary, of course, when you're monitoring. Monitoring is the fifth step, the fifth basic action of thinking. When setting a purpose is not something that is set and forget. When you say, I'm going to try to solve this problem, if you don't check in relatively often in a thinking process and say, okay, are we still on track to solving this problem? You could easily get distracted. Distraction happens automatically. There are automatic processes of the mind that will grab your attention and put it on something else. So emotions are designed to grab your attention and put it on something else. Moving objects built into your mind is that if in perception a moving object goes by, it will grab your attention and turn it to that. There are built-in functions of, in effect, the perceptual memory affect system that are designed to grab your attention. And so the fact that you can set a purpose and you can direct your attention doesn't mean that it's going to be set and forget, because you need to check and see, oh, has my attention been dragged off? There's no shame in having your attention dragged off. But if you don't catch it, you're in trouble. And there's a little shame if you never catch it. But if you catch it eventually, sooner is better than later, then you just regroup, say, oh, I'm off topic. Let me get back on topic. But that requires monitoring. That requires initiating a check. Am I still on my intended purpose? So let me just get a check. Do these five things sound like things you do all the time? I mean, does anyone think any of these are unfamiliar? I'm kind of assuming that so far, these are processes that say, yep, I do that. Yes, I do that. I get what you're talking about. But if there's anyone who finds any of them puzzling, I want to hear now. Okay, I think we're all on board on that. So how do tactics help with this? Well, they really do help with these basics. And of course, thinking on paper is the preeminent thinking tactic. I really am on a campaign to teach everyone in the world thinking on paper. Anyone I can get to, I want to teach thinking on paper. It's available for free in my Thinking Direction Starter Kit. Get everyone you know to get the Thinking Direction Starter Kit. I've got the four guidelines for thinking on paper here, and let's just look at this. I would say what makes a thinking tactic is it's some kind of a paper process with preset steps to add some command and control to the thinking process, right? I told you, you need to monitor, you need to keep on track. A thinking tactic helps with that part and helps make sure that you are doing it effectively. Now, the reason you need a tactic for this, if for any reason the thinking is not going super smoothly, is that there's a challenge in adding more command and control. You need to add some self-awareness, but you do not want to screw up the interaction between your mind and the stuff coming up from the subconscious. There needs to be, gee, I just used that word, coming up from memory. There needs to be a really smooth interaction between setting intentions and material coming up. If too much comes up, you can get overloaded and stopped. If not enough comes up, you can be blank and stopped. If it's pulling you in two different directions, you can get stopped. So there needs to be kind of an easy flow where you're getting the helpful information you need at a regular rate. And if you add micromanaging into a thinking process and you try to do it mentally, typically it totally screws up that interaction. And so what a paper process can do is it can add self-awareness without adding crow overload. And it can help you kind of smooth out getting data up from memory and making the judgments and asking the questions. If it slows everything down and lets you go a little more step by step. Let's just look at the guidelines for thinking on paper. Now, I'm assuming everyone on this call has taken advantage of my offer and has checked out thinking on paper. It's a fairly simple process. I highly recommend it. If it doesn't work for you, you should definitely join the Thinking Lab because this is the most useful tool for becoming a more effective thinker. The essential thing of what it is you write out your thoughts in full sentences as you're doing it. But you always start by writing down the goal. Why? Because this makes sure that you actually do set a purpose. I can't tell you how many people, when I've taught thinking on paper, were surprised when they sat down that they didn't know what their goal was. They'd been mulling over something and they finally set down the goal. As soon as they wrote down the goal, they knew what the answer was. Just giving yourself the extra push to say, okay, so what's my goal? Can be very helpful in focusing your thinking. The second guideline is record your thoughts in full sentences following the main line of thinking. Slow down the thinking to match the pace of writing. This is the thing I get the most flack on whenever I teach this. This is how you make sure you are articulating the thoughts. You need to put them in full sentences. This is not, you need to do this in your own mind too if you're doing that silently. If you're just bopping between ideas, you aren't actually thinking and it won't be productive. You actually do need to be connecting the dots. And when you do this as thinking on paper, you get a lot of benefits. Just by writing it out, you spend more time on that thought, on that identification. A thought is an identification of an idea that's come up from memory. That gives you automatically a chance to judge it. Just by using writing, the judging will happen. When you finish writing the sentence, it'll either be true or it'll be false. And if it's true, you'll be ready to go on. And if it's false, you'll say, that's not true. And you will immediately catch yourself and figure out, you know, in effect, regroup. The writing really helps with the judging. It's very, we're all, because we're literate, right? We're practiced at reading things and saying, no, that doesn't compute. Or yeah, that makes sense. That's what you get as you're doing the thinking on paper. So the writing out in full sentences helps with both articulating the thoughts and with judging the thoughts. The third guideline is whenever you hesitate, write down a helpful question to get your thoughts moving on a path toward the goal, then answer the question. So asking questions is a basic thing. Now, this is very vague advice for thinking on paper, but I think it is helpful to realize what you're looking for is a helpful question. You're not just asking questions. You know, there are books on questions, which at one point I bought two or three books on questions because, you need to know the right questions to ask. But oh my God, they are mind numbing. You have 200 pages of, each page with 40 questions on a page. You just reel in your seat when you look at these books. The whole point in asking questions is what would be helpful given my purpose, given my goal? And so part of the reason that having this guideline is helpful is it reminds you, you're not just trying to come up with questions. You're trying to come up with questions that will help you solve the problem or figure out how to get this value that you want or figure out what you need to do first if you're planning. And that guidance can be very helpful to just keep you on a common sense track of going forward. And then, of course, the fourth guideline is to monitor your progress and redirect as needed. Monitoring is much easier when you do thinking on paper. Monitoring is absolutely necessary in all thinking processes, but when you have written a goal at the top of the page and started writing full sentences, first of all, you notice if your hand stops. You definitely notice if you've gotten off track. It is easier to notice, to monitor a physical process than it is to monitor a mental process. Monitoring a mental process takes some of the circuits, takes some of the bandwidth. And so that's one of the big benefits of thinking on paper. And I think actually, I would say that all tactics involve paper. And so they have this benefit for monitoring, they have this benefit for making the goal purposeful. And they all, in some way, help guide the process. Now, sometimes you they a lot of thinking tactics actually help with they actually help with giving you questions that are going to be helpful. But I'll talk about that in a second with complaining. Now, I claim that even the smartest, most effective thinkers benefit from using these. Now, I absolutely believe this is true with thinking on paper. We have the journals of Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand did thinking on paper. Leonard Peikoff, in his Art of Thinking, said whenever he ran into trouble, he'd write thinking at the top of the page. He'd stop writing, he'd stop trying to write the book, and he'd switch to thinking. Everybody I know that I admire uses thinking on paper. I mean, they're the people who taught it to me. And the reason is that my husband Harry Binswanger says he does most of his thinking on paper on the computer. And he does it for, whatever he's working on. And he says when it gets really hard, he switches to paper and and pen, and he uses a really fancy fountain pen. And the reason he does that is he really needs to slow down and he really needs to go step by step. So I think for the most effective thinkers, this all seems naturally, and just the advice, hey, do your thinking on paper as you're doing it, is very helpful. If you have some problems, this can also help you. So, for example, as I said, setting that purpose has really made a big difference for a lot of people who suddenly all their thinking came into focus. The full sentences make a huge difference. I've had people who were diagnosed with ADD and ADHD who said thinking on paper completely changed their ability to concentrate. And it's because of those two things, the purpose and the full sentences. It just gives you something physical that you can monitor, that you can keep going. It slows you down. You don't chase all those thoughts, because one of the things about slowing it down is that you need to pick one and you write that out. You actually identify that thought. I think knowing that it's questions that get you going again helps a lot of people. Because when you get blank, when it just peters out, you can really not know what to do. And knowing that what you need is really the general thing I would say is ask an easier, helpful question. Knowing that that's something that you could do, that all you're trying to do is to get more relevant information out of your data banks. I think people who can easily say, oh, but I don't know the answer, they kind of teach it as a test. Excuse me, they treat it as a test. And so they get a little nervous when they like have to perform in a thinking process. They can learn, no, I'm just trying to understand what's in my memory banks. And I think the monitoring and judging part is very helpful, that sometimes people kind of take whatever happens in their mind for granted and realizing, no, you know, the things that come up, they can be mistaken. That can be eye-opening for some people, that you really just can't take for granted, even though something, it, you know, it zipped through your mind and it seemed to make sense. But then when you write it down, you think, boy, that doesn't make sense. I think actually the complaining tactic can really show this. Now, I don't assume you guys have all done complaining, but you might try it based on these exercises. Let me tell you a little bit about complaining. It's a variation on thinking on paper, but it's more specific. And I've written it up here for resistance. So if you are resisting doing a task, you know, you've got some contrary motivation here that definitely needs to be untangled. It does not make sense. If you think this is the right thing to do and you feel an aversion to doing it, there's some disconnect. Either you've either got some contradiction in your thinking or you've got some conflict between two values and you don't know what that is. So what this tactic does is it gives you some guidelines. It gives you some rails to help you do this. And you see it starts by sentence stems. Now, sentence stems are just questions in disguise made a little bit more easy to answer. So instead of why do you think this task is impossible, which sounds a little like puts you on the spot, you start writing on your thinking, on your page, this task is impossible because. And I tell you, if you write that first half of that sentence down, something, and you're feeling resistance, something will pop up to finish the sentence. And this makes it a little easier to pull that stuff out of your data banks, out of your memory. And you see, I've got several of them here. If I pursue this goal, the following terrible things will happen. And then, oh my God, you get a list of all the terrible things that are going to happen. I'm going to burn out. It's going to take longer than I thought. It's going to be painful, you know, whatever it is. This is really giving the contrary motivation a fair hearing, which is a general piece of advice I give, but this is a tactic for doing it, a very easy tactic. Now, something I noticed I didn't put on here in the real instructions, if you get the Thinker's Toolkit, which thank you, Susie, for putting the Thinker's Toolkit, which is a paid, you know, it's $20 for the PDF version. I recommend you only spend 3 minutes complaining, because 3 minutes of complaints are fine. That's all you need. Then you'll have given contrary motivation a fair hearing. After you complain, you know, the second step is challenge these first thoughts. This is where, so the complaining step really helps you see that there is relevant data. You feel blank, when you feel the resistance, this stuff isn't coming up. It's probably being suppressed a little bit at the sides. But when you give yourself permission to complain, it all comes out. And that really helps you understand, wow, when I am willing to listen to the thoughts, I can hear the thoughts, I can name what they are. Very important. Very important to be okay. You know, there are no unthinkable thoughts. It's very, the fact that you have a thought does not mean you are going to act on it. The fact that you have a thought does not mean you are a bad person. The thought just means that some combination of the way your memory banks are organized and what you're aware of right now popped up that combination. That's all it means. And you can reorganize your memory banks and you can choose whether to act on that thought. So the fact you have a thought is never a problem. It can be wrong. It can be irrational. It can be stupid. Or it can have a grain of truth. And that's actually one of the really interesting things that happens when you complain. Second step, you look at it with a fishy eye and you ask yourself, is that literally true? Does that really follow? Who cares? You know, basically, is this relevant? And you'd be surprised how often when you're resisting a task that one of the complaints gives an extremely good reason why you really shouldn't be doing this task right now. I mean, not always, but I can't tell you how many times I've sat down because I thought I should be working on, say, an article. And when I complained about it, I realized that there was some urgent deadline. I really needed to do another task now because it had to get done before, you know, like call about a medical thing and they're going to close at 4 p.m. and I won't be able to reach them for three more days. It's amazing how often when you give contrary motivation a fair hearing, there is a darn good reason for your resistance, even though when you sat down and you felt the resistance, you didn't think it was appropriate. You thought you should know what you should do. You don't really know until you have found out the cause of that resistance. And that's what the first step identifies the thoughts. The second step judges them. So this is really practice in judging your own thoughts. And that's very important for really recognizing you're in charge of your thoughts. The fact that thoughts occur to you does not make you act on them. You get to judge them and decide whether they are relevant, whether they're true, what you're going to do with them. And then finally, this is literally, you do 3 minutes of complaining, you go and you read every sentence and you judge it, and then you do what I call a mental cleanup. This is actually a tactic I have people do by themselves. So you list your takeaways, open questions, and next steps. And this particular tactic really helps you realize, yes, I have made progress, because you actually know some things you did not know before you started this. Open questions. You may not have solved all of the problems in the world. That's okay. Writing down your open questions helps to preserve that context and helps to identify the things you still want to know. Next steps is the most important thing. What I think the biggest problem with most people's thinking, people who have problems with thinking, the biggest problem is that they get stuck and they just go off and they never actually get into action. And they think they need to do more thinking before they can decide what to do. And the truth is, all you need to act is you need to know a good next step. Certainty, all you need for certainty is to know that this step would be a good step. You do not need to know it's the best step. You do not need to know that it's going to lead to perfect success. It could just get you a little more knowledge. It could get things a little bit clearer. It's definitely a step in the right direction. That's all you need to know in order to get into action. And if what you're feeling is resistance, the most important thing is to get into action. And so this third part of this helps you understand the simplicity of certainty, which I think is a huge bugaboo for a lot of people's thinking. Now, the reason I ran into that, I wanted to show how yet another tactic helps you with these basic processes. But the big thing is a tactic like complaining helps you to integrate your knowledge and values to be consistent. You know, if you don't give that contrary motivation a fair hearing, you do not know what little bits of knowledge or what values are in conflict here. Until you identify the thoughts that underlie these, you do not know why there's a conflict. And if there is a conflict, you can't resolve it without identifying it. The way that you integration, basically identifying a thought, articulating a thought is one way you integrate. Another way is by reaching a conclusion. Another way is by judging. When you say this is true, that helps to integrate it. When you say this is false, that helps to disintegrate it. All of that conscious process is required to rewire the connections so that they will be consistent. Thinking is your means of integrating your knowledge and values. And anything that helps you identify conflicts and contradictions sooner rather than later, so you can resolve them sooner rather than later, is helping you to integrate your entire memory banks. That is really the goal. You know, I mean, there are a number of different ways that I could go here, but if you just think happiness, right, is a state of non-contradictory joy, your values need to be all integrated for that to happen. If you have two totally conflicting values that are pulling you in two different directions, you are not going to have non-contradictory joy. And that takes a thinking process. It takes prioritization is one of the things that is needed there. One other thing on certainty. You know, if you are uncertain about what you should do, you almost certainly need more information. And then you can be certain that you should take a step that will actually bring you new information from the world. I think the other mistake that I see thinkers make sometimes is they think that their problem needs to be solved entirely by looking within. But, you know, extrospection is a really important part of gaining knowledge. And more often than not, what you need is some kind of an experiment. You need to go out into the world and experiment. And this is true even if what you're trying to understand is your own motivation. This is something I teach in the Thinking Lab. If you aren't sure why you're feeling, you know, conflicting motivation, if you take a step in the direction that you think makes sense, you will get new clarity about what the source of this conflict is. And you actually cannot resolve it without taking action. So it's very, very important. Any questions about complaining and how the second promise was it makes it faster and easier to integrate your knowledge and values to be self-consistent. Any questions about that or why that's true? Okay, great. Let's see. The third promise I had is it's going to eliminate blankness, overload, conflict, and other dysfunctional states that waste time. So this is the idea of dysfunctional states is my idea. And I think it's a really important concept, which is why I'm touting it here. What I mean by a dysfunctional state is a mental state in which the automatic functions of attention are interfering with a thinking process. You know, I said earlier that you can emotions are designed to grab your attention and move them off. Moving objects, your attention system is designed to move your attention to look at the moving object. This is built in, folks. There are processes that are designed to deterministically grab your attention. So yes, our locus of free will is our ability to direct our attention. And there are also automatic processes that will move it off. So if any of these processes are happening, it will actually interfere with the thinking process. And there here are the cases that I think are worth talking about. So like distraction, I mentioned, where you get pulled off your purpose. To think you need to stay on your purpose. Now, a little distraction, you can just manage as part of thinking by monitoring. But a big distraction can really get in the way of thinking. Overload. So now what happens with overload? Why is that a problem? Well, that means that a lot of ideas are coming up from memory, more ideas than you can actually articulate at a time. So many that, you know, if you try to articulate one, you kind of lose everything else that came up. And of course, as I said, thinking, you're asking questions and listening for the answers. You're trying to integrate around a purpose. If you get that much information, you cannot easily select what is relevant. It just kills the thinking process. So what do you do then? Well, you need to do something to slow down the input. This is why thinking on paper, I think, is a really excellent solution to overload. Just switching to paper will help with overload, right? Just writing the purpose at the top will help with distractions. Just switching to paper will help with overload. If you still have trouble, you should make a list, right? A list is like the basic solution to overload. Paper is the thing that, concepts are devices to reduce overload, but paper is the power tool for reducing overload. And of course, yes, you can do this on a computer, but I find paper to be more effective. But I'm not going to, for the digital natives, I'm sure they should do it on a computer. Blankness is another kind of overload. So, right, so if you're in the, excuse me, another kind of dysfunctional state. Now, this is, okay. Adam suggests I use the term evolved rather than designed to refer built-in mental and biological things. That's true. They are evolved, right? Yes, that is actually, I appreciate that precision in terms. Thank you, Adam. Okay, my other dysfunctional states, blankness. So blankness is a dysfunctional state, right? You, if you're totally blank, you're like paralyzed. You know, you have no idea what you should be thinking about right now. The way that thinking tactics help with that is that they give you some clues as what to do next. It's like, well, I can ask an easier question. What would be an easier question? You have now asked an easier question. Yay, you're actually thinking again. Or if you're complaining, it's, oh, I just need to fill in this sentence stem. Good, I can do that. They give you actual instructions for what to do next. That is helpful when you're blank. When you're in conflict, I think one of the things that these thinking tactics do is because they basically help you activate the full context. That's what all of these tactics do. They help you make sure that you have made explicit the relevant information from your knowledge banks. And that is the thing that is going to do one of two things. It's either going to make it so the conflict becomes a non-issue. Like you were saying, resisting sitting down to write an email. And you realized that the source of the resistance is just, oh, you know, it's going to be kind of messy to write because I need to be, you know, I need to worry about this politics or something like that. And you think, you know what, it's not going to get any easier. It actually would be easier to do a short thing now than then. The conflict just goes away. And that often happens just by slowing it down, giving contrary motivation a fair hearing. On the other hand, sometimes what this does is it really raises it, say, hey, there is a real issue here. So, for example, one of the people in the current launch is a 8-week program. It's like an add-on to the Thinking Lab that I run 3 times a year, where we work on achieving a major goal. And one of the people in the launch realized he really has a conflict because he really wants to have two careers. He wants to be an artist and he wants to be a technical person. And that was really pulling on him. And what this kind of thinking does is says, okay, yeah, I need to figure that out. This is a real prioritization issue and I haven't solved it. And that is what I would call an open question, something that can't be solved in a few minutes of thinking. You actually need to go on a campaign to, in fact, do some experiments and figure out how can you have both of these things in your life? And if not, how do they conflict? And, you know, it actually takes work to resolve that kind of a very big conflict. So I think the benefit of thinking tactics for these dysfunctional states, first of all, if you get into one of them, you should immediately switch to thinking on paper. If you're in the middle of thinking on paper and one of these hits, it's very easy to catch. So the tactics help you both identify that you're, excuse me, if you're, they help you, if you're using them, identify that you're in them. And if you're not using them, or when you use them, they help you exit them. Now, it's not that you should use thinking tactics all the time, right? You use thinking tactics on the things, on the most difficult work that you have, on the most important work you have, on the stuff that needs that extra 10% or 20%, or the stuff that would benefit from that, the stuff that's most important. The general rule of thumb I have is, you know, it's like if you're stuck for 3 minutes, thinking on paper is absolutely going to speed it up. I rate the tactics. This is, I mentioned there's a library of 60 thinking tactics. They're all rated for how long they take. You can tell whether a tactic is appropriate by how stuck you are on the issue. If you've spent a half a day festering over something, it's worth a 3-hour tactic. I have a tactic called Judge Your Neighbor that takes 3 hours. And if you're festering over some social thing that happened, it is totally worth spending 3 hours to do that tactic. If you've already lost a day or something like that. Now, on the other hand, if you've only been bothered for 15 seconds, you should definitely not do Judge Your Neighbor. That would be insane. If it's only 15 seconds, you can just try to solve it in your head. But if it gets to 3 minutes, or, you know, try something else. And there's a whole graded set of tactics that can help depending on how the evidence that you have of how hard the thinking task is. So this is a good time for me to give that ad for the Thinking Lab. I've already mentioned, you know, there are There's a library of 60 or so tools. There are like 20 courses. These are things like Do What Matters Most, which is my course on how do you deal with overload, temptation and resistance. And it's got my basic advice on how to stay oriented to values. How do you decide what is the right thing to do? How do you deal with temptation? How do you deal with the resistance? So it's like the basic course. At this point, when people come into the Thinking Lab, I recommend they do that first. I have a course on rational goal setting. This is something that one of the reasons that you can have trouble producing is if you set the goals too difficult or too easy. If they're too easy, they're boring. If they're too difficult, you don't know how to do them. And I've been pursuing some very difficult goals in my life. And I had to figure out how do I set them so that I can stay motivated to work on them. And I have a whole course on rational goal setting, which involves not just making sure they're small enough, but also making sure they're meaningful enough. And we did that, I guess, a year ago in the Thinking Lab. We finished that one. There's a course called Self-Direction Theory and Practice. Now, self-direction is different from self-discipline and self-indulgence. I think self-discipline is when you make yourself do what you think you should do. I don't think you should ever force yourself to do something. I think that that's as bad as forcing someone else. You should not force your mind or anyone else's. But self-indulgence doesn't work. If you just wait until the spirit moves you, you will never get anything done. What you need is you need a third alternative, which I call self-direction, which is very strategic, where you really figure out why it is that you are not motivated to do it. And you give yourself little tests. Like the basic way you do self-direction is you figure out the positive reason why you really do think you should be doing this. You check the contrary motivation. You see, you agree. You definitely think you should do this. You still feel some resistance and you give yourself 10 minutes. Okay, I'm going to take action for 10 minutes. I can handle 10 minutes of, you know, resistance and whatever, and see if I get over the hump. And it's amazing how often you get over the hump. And if you don't get over the hump, what you get is a lot more information about the source of the resistance that can help you then figure out what to do. And then there's also a variation of that that's 2 hours. If you really need to change the way you're doing business, sometimes you need to sit down and keep yourself doing what you need to do for 2 hours. There's different, what, you know, thinking is entirely individual. And what these tactics are is they're guidelines and advice for how to apply them. And that's an example of where it's not, none of these are cookbook solutions. There's not like you go in and there's a cookbook solution. You need to learn a tactic on some real issue for you and get help maybe applying it there so that you have that tactic you can use on whatever issues come up and you can adapt that tactic as you go forward. I'm just going to mention a couple others. I don't want to take too long on this. There's a class on All About Emotions. There's a class on The Work of Happiness. We actually have two bonus classes for that coming up in November. I have a class called Evolving a Scheduling Infrastructure. This is basically my time management class. I think you need some kind of schedule, some way to keep track of time, some way to plan the week. And it's unique to every person. This is not a cookbook solution. And what you need to do is you need to start with something that you can do right now. So if you have no time management, you need something that is fairly simple and easy to add some structure, and then you can build onto it. And if you have a fairly complex, well, then you can start there and tweak it and make it better. And that is, that's like one of the first courses that was ever put into the Thinking Lab site, like back in like 2009 or something like that. And so we're going to redo the whole course starting in December. So I'm actually pretty excited about that because I have a lot of new material on that. And that brings me to, so the other part you get with the Thinking Lab, you can ask me questions about anything. People don't take advantage of this, but I do answer email questions from Thinking Labbers, sometimes at great length. Sometimes they turn into blog posts. There are two new classes every month. Every month, there's at least one open Q&A session, either an hour or a thinking day. Thinking days are, sometimes they're holidays, sometimes they're Saturdays. I'm on the bridge from 10 to noon Eastern, from 2 to 3 Eastern, and from 5 to 6 Eastern. And I'm there to answer any questions, do any coaching, help. And we always end with a celebration. People schedule that day to do a bunch of work, and they come at the end and everybody celebrates how much they got done. They're actually really fun. Thinking days are really fun. And of course, there's also optional one-on-one coaching. I have Lynn Zinser on the call here. She is the head coach for the Thinking Lab. And there is, you can get coaching with her on any of the tactics. So the Thinking Lab is a great program. It's like the best kept secret around here. It's only $75 a month. It is way cheaper than the competition that I know about. And there's a 3-month minimum. So it is a $225 commitment, but I do have a special offer for the first 5 people who sign up today, meaning before midnight tonight. I'm going to offer a free consult on one of the essentialization skills. I didn't mention those, but in the Thinking Lab is also all my work on condensation, concretization, and definitions. If what you really want is not help just doing regular everyday thinking, but you want to increase your logical skills, or you want to raise your standards, you want to be more precise, you want to be more integrated, you want to be more direct, those are the skills. Those are the skills that helped me really raise the level of my thinking. And they are, you know, there's like homework for them. And so the deal is, you join the Thinking Lab today. This is new people. Join the Thinking Lab today. Do one of the exercises in one of those. It's not, you know, this is going to take you an hour or two to do the exercise, and send it to me before December 15th. We will, sometime between now and the end of the year, I will give you a tutorial on that. I do not offer one-on-one tutorials. This is just for the first 5 people who sign up today. Okay. That's the sell. I've got some questions. I have one other bonus point. Why don't I go ahead, make my bonus point, close, and then answer questions? Unless there's one right now. Let's see. Here's my bonus. What is the number one source of distraction that messes up people's thinking? Anyone got a vote for what that is? Anyone got an idea for what the number one distraction that totally screws up people's thinking?
Emotion.
Well, that's a great guess. Self-criticism. The reason, hey, Susie got it just as I said it. All right, Susie. The reason I say self-criticism is it masks as being thinking. You say, well, you know, I should be doing this. Oh, what a jerk I am for not doing this. I should just buckle down and do it. And all this self-criticism actually gets in the way of figuring out why you aren't doing it. It's a total diversion from what your purpose is. And I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there in the self-help about, oh, you can't be self-critical. Of course, there's a time and a place where you need to be super self-critical. But when that's directly related to your purpose, if what you're trying to figure out is why you're feeling resistance, criticizing yourself for feeling resistance is not on purpose. It's not relevant to the purpose. You need to actually give yourself permission to give a fair hearing. If you're trying to figure out how to achieve a goal, rehearsing all the reasons why you failed in the past and giving yourself a hard time for it does not help you figure it out, right? So I think this is like the number one thing that I see people who think that they're in an effective thinking process are actually totally diverted by self-criticism, and it gets them off track. And as a result, they don't figure out what they're trying to figure out. And that's something that, you know, there are a lot of tools. A lot of the tools in the Thinking Lab actually involve managing motivation, emotions, you know, giving contrary motivation a fair hearing. But this is related to what Jan said. Of course, the self-criticism triggers negative emotions, which also makes them not want to think about it. But the problem with the self-criticism is it's off topic and it diverts you from the issue. And because it triggers all those negative emotions, it's likely if you don't catch it and you don't get back on track, it's likely to send you off in some behavior that's not too helpful. That was my bonus point. So the general conclusion here is thinking tactics, huge benefit, really worth it to learn. You can learn them quickly. If you already really know all this, the tactics are just something you lap up. If you have trouble in thinking about certain kinds of things, getting a tactic that particularly helps you with that, super helpful. What they do, they help you systematically activate the knowledge you have and the values that are relevant. That is huge. That means that you make the best use of your mind. You use the best that you know to make your decisions. They make it easier for you to catch your mistakes just by raising that self-awareness, just by writing out things. You cannot help but notice if you really put a nutty thing in there. One of the five slots is gone. Thank you for letting me know, Susie. So I didn't say much about emotions. I have a ton of stuff on emotions. And what they do is they make it more likely that you will notice your emotions. And the reason they do that is because you're clearer on what you're trying to do. And if like the pen stops, you're going to notice, oh, yeah, why? I don't want to write that thought. Oh, what that thought? What is that thought? Okay, there are no unthinkable thoughts. What is that thought? You're going to notice. You're going to have physical behavior that is going to help you to catch something's going on. They improve your judgment partly by activating the full context, partly by making it impossible not to be to leave things implicit. They make it all explicit, way harder to not judge things. You know, when it's just kind of in the background, it's easy to not notice and not make a judgment. When you spell it out in a sentence, it's like, that's not true. It's like, oh, gee, that's second-handed. What am I going to do about that? That doesn't make sense. They make it easier for you to monitor. And the result is more effective thinking and over the long term, faster and more complete integration of your knowledge and values. So thinking tactics, I am a big advocate of thinking tactics. And I hope I have either encouraged some people here or sold some people here on that benefit. So with that, that's like the end of the formal program. We have some questions. So I see a couple in the chat. If you have others, you can raise your hand. And I'm going to go up. I'm just going to start at the top here because Adam wanted to know from the very beginning, the question that I seeded. Can you explain why you do not use psychoepistemology and subconscious? So you can see I've explained all this. I did slip once and use subconscious instead of memory. All of the things I'm talking, thinking really is an interaction between your conscious mind and the automatic functions of your subconscious. And for those who don't know, the term psychoepistemology is a new term that Ayn Rand coined. And she defined it as the study of man's cognitive processes. So this would be like the study of man's thinking, right? Not just thinking, but mostly thinking. From the aspect of the interaction between the conscious mind and the automatic functions of the subconscious. And this is really what, you know, I have for years, for 25 years, I called myself a psychoepistemologist because the reason I went into psychology was I wanted to study psychoepistemology. This is what interested me. Thinking interested me, not emotions, not motivation. And my husband gave some very important lectures on psychoepistemology. That's Harry Binswanger. There's psychoepistemology and psychoepistemology too. And I, you know, ingested all of those and learned a lot of things about thinking from him and other people. And because psychoepistemology was my focus, every problem, every mental problem I had from the time I left engineering in 1992 until the present, I have analyzed from the aspect of the interaction between the conscious mind and the automatic functions of the subconscious. And the thing I've concluded is you need to study action from the standpoint of the interaction between the conscious mind and the automatic functions of the subconscious. That's the Alexander technique. Some of you have seen my recommendations for that. It turns out that the use of the body, because we have volition, we can override the natural organization of the natural coordination of the body. Little kids, like little 2 and 3 year olds, have beautiful coordination for the most part. But that can get overridden by choice because you can choose to move your body whatever you want. You can choose to tense up muscles. And most back problems and a lot of other problems come from misuse of the body. And the Alexander technique is, how do you undo all those bad habits and let the natural coordination go forward? And it's all about, how do you use your conscious mind to, in effect, trigger or not trigger the automatic functions that are going on. And so action needs to be studied this way. The other is motivation. So emotions and all other kind. Motivation, which is mostly emotions, need to be understood as an interaction between your awareness, what gets triggered up from memory, and in effect, the expectations that are triggered from memory because of past experiences. It's all about the interaction. So the reason I don't use the term psychoepistemology, because I think that psychology is the study of man's mental processes from the aspect of the interaction between the conscious mind and the automatic functions of the subconscious. I don't think you can understand perception without that, because you need to understand the awareness and you need to understand what gets stored in memory. So I think it's the science of psychology needs to be defined in these terms. I think she nailed the essence of psychology. It's not a branch of psychology. This is how you should look at the whole field. This is not a widely held position, but that's why I don't use the term psychoepistemology. Adam, are you still around, or maybe you had to step away? He'll have to get it on the recording, I guess. All right. Now, the other one that I said that I see is, why don't I use the term subconscious? So this one is really radical for people who are interested in objectivism. Ayn Rand uses the term subconscious all the time. It's in the definition of psychoepistemology. So actually, I would say, yes. Oh, you're there.
Already
hear my answer?
Put the thanks in the chat.
Oh, you put the thanks in the chat. Okay, thank you. Okay, great. So the reason I don't use the term subconscious, actually Lee Pearson really convinced me of this, is that the way it's used in objectivism is that there's this mysterious subconscious processing. It's like, oh, that's the subconscious does that. And there's been a kind of, it's like a black box. And I actually think every single thing that needs to be explained can be explained by a very simple model of memory and an affect system, or what Ayn Rand called the pleasure-pain mechanism. I think if you have a very simple idea of memory where, you know, in effect, discriminated objects get stored in memory as like nodes in memory, and then affective experiences, if you have a big change in affect, events or incidents that involve a big change of affect get stored, and that these can get chained together in various ways. I think with that, you can actually explain how values form. I think you can explain how values can form without your having intentionally acted to gain and keep something, but just having experienced things, you can actually have motivation form. Because that is one of the problems with motivation, is that some of your motivation you understand because you see how you made choices in the past that led to it. And other stuff, it's like confusing. Like PTSD is a good example. You have an experience and it gets stored in a certain way, and that affects your motivational system. And that needs to be, that I think can all be explained by a fairly simple model of memory and affect. And I think part of what you need to think of is that memory is the source of all quote unquote experience. So when you look inside and you have like an inner experience, actually, that's not quite right. Your feelings, part of that is affect and part of that is stuff coming up from memory. And that's not awareness, right? As I said, it doesn't become awareness until you focus on it and conceptualize it. And when you actually turn into thoughts, then it becomes an awareness of something. But it's part of how, as thinkers, we need to actually notice the feelings, because the feelings are alerts of some kind. And we need to access the stored data, which could be out of date or could be mistaken in various ways. And if you, with a very fairly simple model of these two things, I think you can explain everything. And so we don't need another word for memory. And we do need a word for the pleasure pain mechanism, or the affective system is what I call it. But there's nothing else to be explained, in my view. And so that's why I don't use the term subconscious. I think memory is a lot clearer. I just the other day, like a couple of weeks ago, there was an article on my husband's or a post on my husband's, the Harry Binswanger letter on the forum there. Someone was talking about values, and I said, look, values are stored in memory. And that was like a revelation to the person. They were just, you know, when you say it's, oh, it's in the subconscious, it's like the subconscious knows what your values are. Something. No, a value is something that you have acted to gain and or keep. And that has gotten stored as a result of the action and the affect and the awareness. And so that's why I don't use the term subconscious anymore. Although it's still difficult to never use it because I used it for 30 years. Okay. Okay, let's see. What do I think about the techniques of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy? Generally, I'm in favor of them. I mean, that, you know, that's specifically for dealing with emotional challenges, right? Depression, anxiety. You know, there are good processes for introspecting emotions from CBT. There are good processes for getting yourself into action. I'm generally in favor of them. I think that they're not all perfect, and it depends very much on the person. The person I like best is David Burns, actually. And Ellen put him on. Well, actually, I found him in various ways, but she's the one who has really reinforced that over the years. So, and you'll see there's some similarities between what I say in CBT. The problem with CBT is it's not a problem. It's good as so far as it goes. We have a second new member. All right, great. Two down, three to go. Do you have any recommendations for slowing your thinking to match your pace of writing? So I do think that that is an act of will, in the sense that you need to actually say, okay, I really want to know what this thought is. It's like you need to love your mind and say, I want to know what this thought is, and I'm going to focus there. And so that's one part of it. The other part is you need to really trust. You know, the reason you want to zoom off is because you've got a whole bunch of great ideas. And the reason you want to slow down is to give some time to consider this thought, which for whatever reason you thought was the one to focus on first, right? You thought, so I don't know if you have an example, John, but if you want to talk about this, feel free to unmute. And guys, feel free to raise your hand if you want to talk through these. We don't have to just do it in the chat. But if you have a thought, you focus on it, it's going to take you whatever, say 3 seconds to write it. You're going to be thinking that thought for that whole 3 seconds. What that means is and you need to know that that actually makes a difference, because that means that gives time for all those other things that were coming on to settle. And it will be easier to see which is the most important thought to focus on next at the end of those 3 seconds. So it's partly really wanting to identify this, really wanting to get clear on this, and partly trusting that that clarity is going to help you to figure out the next thing. Now, there are some exceptions. You want to unmute, John? Looks like you want to unmute.
Those are excellent suggestions. I mean, what I do as a step, interim step to slow me down a bit in the thought process is use an outline.
Okay.
Create a fast outline, all kinds of, and there might be one or two words. And that sets me into a focus for doing thinking on paper.
Well, that's great. I was going to say that if you're really overloaded, make a list, and that's what you do with your outline, right? An outline is an organized list. If it's too hard to do an outline, just do a haphazard list. Don't try to put it in order. But yes, that is, if you're really feeling overloaded, make a list. That is what I'd recommend. Good, John?
Good, thank you.
Okay, great. Let's see. What do you recommend for someone who has trouble defining a productive purpose and a value hierarchy? Okay, great. So I actually have a course on finding a central purpose in the Thinking Lab. And I'll tell you the basic thing that I recommend. you need to get, it depends a little bit on whether you have a generalized direction or you just know some things you like. But the general thing I recommend is you give yourself a few minutes, a few months to figure it out. And you literally spend like 20 or 30 minutes a day thinking on paper about what you want, what you dream about, why this would be good. You want to actually get more in touch with your existing values and your existing dreams. And the thing that I offer in the Thinking Lab is I offer like 10 different suggestions on things that you could think about in those half hours. And because part of it is you really need to give yourself a chance to kind of mull over it. You do some thinking. This thinking on paper is great for this. You do a half an hour and then you percolate on it overnight. And then the next day you kind of come from a different place. You do another half hour, you pick up. And it gets you actually seriously thinking about what you want, what gives meaning to your life, what you wish you could do, without having the pressure to figure out, well, what do I do next? Because that's the thing that often shuts down people. They actually have a dream. They have something they really want to do, but there's some practical issue with it. And I'm a big believer that you need to figure out what you really want. And then there is some practical way to get that meaning in your life, but you've got to know what you really want first. And for that, you really need to give yourself permission to do that. You do define a central purpose. You don't define a value hierarchy. You have a value hierarchy. And the way that you get more clear on your values and you learn about your value hierarchy is by doing more introspection. And that's, as I said, All About Emotions class has a lot on that. I've got a lot of introspection tools. The Thinker's Toolkit, which is the $20 booklet that I have, has, I think it's three tools that are basically introspective tools. What you want to do, like every time you feel resistance, you want to give that contrary motivation a fair hearing, and you will start to say, oh yeah, I value this and this, and I haven't really sorted out which is more important. Well, right now your value hierarchy is kind of flat. Everything's at the same level of importance. Well, the way that you get it to be more like pointy, so that it's really clear what's important to you, part of it is figuring out a productive central purpose. But part of it is actually looking at, yeah, I value this and this, which is really more important to me? Or if they're both important, what's the thing that's less important that I can drop off the list? Because you do, you know, you have a limited amount of time and energy. And there's a fear of making those choices. You know, people like to talk about FOMO, fear of missing out. Okay, well, how about fear of missing in? If you don't have an integrated value hierarchy, you really, you don't get as much pleasure out of day-to-day life. I mean, I get pleasure. You wouldn't believe the things I get pleasure out of by having a central purpose and having everything integrated around my central purpose. My central purpose is to teach people how to think clearly and logically about value-laden issues. That's my central purpose. And I will tell you, there is nothing that happens at the grocery store, at the gym, you know, talking with clients, going on a vacation, that isn't grist for the mill for that goal. And my experience is anyone with a really, really clear and well-defined central purpose, they find ways to connect it to everything, and everything has more meaning. So it's a matter of your happiness of why you should do this. So don't have fear of missing out, have fear of missing happiness. But it doesn't happen automatically, and you can't decree it. You cannot decree your value hierarchy. What you do is you introspect, what are the things that are currently important to you? And so it's helpful to make a list. The three big areas of, well, actually, they're sort of, depending on how you count them, they're like five big areas of life. So health, very big area of life. What really matters to you health-wise right now? For young people, they may not have realized health needs to be a really top value. As you get older, you realize, boy, I really need to pay attention to health. Every 10 years, you say, oh God, I really need to pay attention to health. Okay, you can tell I'm getting old. There's career, right? Or productiveness. What are your big values in that area? Relationships. Who are your big values? You probably have several big values there. Recreation. You have some hobbies, things like that. Now, I'm going blank. No, I'm not. The fifth one, I think, is, I don't know if it should be on this list or not, but it's something having to do with finances, something having to do with money. And Tal Svani, actually, in his, you know, his happiness team stuff, he's the one who said, look, you got to separate finances from productive work. And I think that's right. You actually do need to have values around money. That's an area that's often also undervalued. That's something I'm working on myself, because to grow my business, I need to value money more. So you can just look at those five categories and see where you are and see what your thoughts are about each of those. And that's a way you can get clearer on what your existing value hierarchy is right now. Even just looking at those five and how you would rate them could be very clarifying. I hope that's helpful to you, Andy. Rainier asks, how do we access the recording of this session? So you will get an email, which will have a link to, actually, I think what it is you're going to get a link to a page. And sometime later today, hopefully pretty soon, I mean, within a few hours, the recording will go up on that page. I think you will get an email after the recording is up on the page. Oh, Susie answered it. Yay, Susie. Thank you. Finance. Susie said finance. Susie is the one who answered all my questions. Susie is my chief of staff. She really runs everything behind the scenes. All right. Well, I've run out of questions. Unless there's another question, I think we've reached a really natural conclusion here. And I had really fun talking about this. As you see, I am very passionate about thinking and about thinking tactics. And I hope I have instilled some of that passion in you. Thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you, Jean.
You're welcome.
Jean.
Thank you.